Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and this is another foundational fantasy episode, but with a twist. Because as you might recall from the previous episode that I did with my friend James, people don't always come to the fantasy genre through books. Sometimes they come to them through different things, and James had mentioned that he came to fantasy mostly through movies. So my guest for this podcast is Ray Jameson, who kind of falls into that category as well, and he's got a really exciting project going on right now, so we're going to talk about that. And then we're going to sort of talk about foundational fantasy kind of as an inspiration for his project. So, Ray, thanks for joining me.
I am happy to be on, man. Anytime I get to talk about anything, fiction, fantasy, etc., it's just a good time. Thanks, man.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So what should my listeners know about you? Like a short history, kind of what's interesting about you?
Short history about me in regards to fantasy? Well, mine has a big overlap with comic books. I'll start with the comic portion, then I'll blend it into fantasy. So first and foremost, I am an 80s baby, and I am the youngest of two. I have an older brother, and much like many second or younger siblings, they usually are a sidekick to the interests of the older sibling for at least the first handful of years of their life. And my brother loved everything that cartoons, action figure companies, and comic companies, when they made that really powerful alliance, that successful, we're really going to bleed every parent's wallet. Buy this comic. You like the comic. Buy this toy. You like this toy. Mm-hmm. Watch this cartoon. And I was right in there. I grew up through that long past the points of my current memory of that time. And there were some really awesome things to come from comic books. I was a big fan of, in regards to all the cartoons, there wasn't just He-Man, Transformers, G.I. Joe. I personally liked Brave Star a lot, but there was other like more traditional comic book like Marvel and DC, especially like Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends or Incredible Hulk that went for a season. That was my brother's favorite. And through all of those eras, going into the 90s, I had the privilege of being able to, I remember that first September, watching the very first episode that was broadcasted of Batman, the animated series, Kevin Conroy and Mark Hamill as the Joker. The first episode broadcasted where I was the one where he first meets the Scarecrow. And it was amazing. Fast forward, going through the 90s, comic books, I had a love-hate relationship because it became, you can't have a comic without both art and story. And through the early, mid to late 90s, comics became lopsided and heavily focused on the art. The art was awesome, don't get me wrong, but it didn't start to course correct until year 2000 with Brian Michael Bendis doing Ultimate Spider-Man. But to make this more on the fantasy side, to blend this more together, eventually, as we passed the turn of the century, I left my family, my friends, and everything else for work opportunity, and I traveled across country. And I always looked for excuses and reasons to hang out with my friends online via webcam. So eventually we started playing Dungeons and Dragons, and we had a lot of fun in the fantasy genre. The fantasy genre, it's really interesting because I think most people want to get away. I mean, it's cool to drive a car. It's not cool when it breaks down and you got to get it repaired. And I think a lot of people romanticize with the concept of a simpler time, but giving fantastical options to it. So being able to cast magic or live in the woods or being able to speak to animals. And the most interesting things I find about fantasy are usually the most simple ones. Something like the Fae being allergic to iron and not being able to cast magic on it. I find that stuff really, really cool and intriguing. It's playing around with our current reality, but changing some rules. And what would the world look like 200, 300, 400 years ago if you implemented all of these things?
Yeah.
And so this was going into the 2010s, of course, when we did this kind of stuff. But I mean, I've watched lots of fantasy footage, including Legend, Conan the Barbarian, obviously Lord of the Rings. That goes without saying. I mean, who hasn't seen that show, that trilogy rather, who is not a fan of fantasy? Even like stuff that wasn't as popular, Aragorn, for example. There's like some really cool stuff out there. And the thing that is the most neat is you can just reestablish the reality to whatever you want it to be. But regardless, as I played Dungeons and Dragons with my friends, I did what was called a homebrew. A homebrew is where you don't use any modules. I established my own lore, my own realm, the cities, the towns, the establishments, the infrastructure, politics, conflict, monsters, etc. And my friends played in that. And I definitely bit off a lot. I chewed it all, but it took a while. I had a steep learning curve being the dungeon master. But with that said and done, that was over 15 years ago that we started doing that. And it's very interesting to look back. I had some really cool stories. I had some really neat things that happened. So I wanted to express in a comic, and comics, like I said, I've loved forever. And I started asking around. I wrote up a story. The script is 3 issues. And it was exactly as things happened, with only one change being I took out the characters that the players were playing as, and I injected my own characters based off of people I know and cultural references and other influences. And it was really, really cool to put this script together. I was surprised how well it melted into place. After that, I started speaking to talent on social media, and I got a lot of no's, don't get me wrong, but I also got I was surprised, some people who said yes, they're definitely in. There's some famous artist, anybody who likes the lore of Spawn. One of the colorists who's colored over 100 issues of that comic, basically 50 to 150, Dan Kemp. One of my cover artists, Harvey A. Salteras. He did the first year of Ghost Rider Volume 2 when Dan Ketch took over as the writer. Really cool stuff. Then this kind of talent... It, for me, getting them to work on my project was the equivalent of having like Kurt Cobain or Elvis Presley perform a song that I've written. I can't believe that they worked with a little old me. And to summarize this story, it's I think everybody, when they get old enough, they have friends, at least one or more, that they don't get to see as much as they used to. And it would be this type of missing somebody, like even if you saw them for 5 minutes in a parking lot when they're passing through a city, that recharges your very essence. You actually feel like, man, I really needed that. This book is an homage to that level of camaraderie. It's told in the theme of fantasy through the medium of a comic book. And any of those things that I just said there, if any of that resonates with you, then you will definitely be interested in this miniseries.
Nice. And we didn't, you warned me before we started going that you wouldn't necessarily need prompts from me, but you kind of moved automatically into talking about the project that you're working on. What's it actually called? We haven't actually mentioned that yet.
For sure. This book is called The Madcaps. The reason I chose that name is the four characters, they live in they're coming back to their hometown. It's called Ivywood. Ivywood is predominantly human and orc. In the story, you don't see any orc, and there's a reason for that. But regardless, these four main characters are not human or orc. So they kind of stood out, and the word madcap, meaning eccentric or different from normal, I felt that was a very fitting phrase to use.
Nice. And this is not in any existing continuity other than with like the history of your D&D campaigns.
You're absolutely right. One of the coolest things about writing this comic that I've told people, no disrespect to comic companies like Marvel or DC, but if you're going to pick up a new issue of Spider-Man, you're probably going to enjoy it a lot more if you have 70 years worth of lore memorized to get every tiny reference.
Yeah.
Somebody who's never read any of those books, any popular, well-established book that's been around for decades, I'm sure there's going to be a page or two once in a while. You have to look up on Reddit or somewhere else. What was this reference? What did this mean? My book, you have to walk into it not knowing anything. And the whole thing takes place in one night. And like the first issue, the first couple pages, it starts with the sun going down. And the last couple of pages in issue 3, the sun is going up. I wanted people to feel like they're trapped in the night with them. I wanted them to feel like they were a fly on the wall watching some friends synergize with each other and rub each other the wrong way. And maybe an inside joke or two you won't fully get, but it establishes that they know each other well enough to make such things.
Nice. And the project right now is on Kickstarter, right? And you've released 2 issues and there's a third forthcoming. Is that correct?
There's a third one coming, 3-issue miniseries total. All 3 issues you will be able to get on Kickstarter. I got the hiccups on April 16th. It'll be going for a month. There's some really cool things on there. Of course, all three issues, the complete story, but there's some really neat stuff on there as well. Anybody that likes playing D&D, there are character sheets that have each character as level 5 characters in 5th edition D&D. So they're kind of adapted over. There are t-shirts and blankets, of course. We've got some surprises coming up, including there's a special edition trilogy where all 3 issues are, they get new covers. And when you put them together, it makes one big picture depicting the final act of the last issue.
Very nice.
So if you're if you like that kind of stuff to hang on your wall, Rod Ramos Rodolfo, when this podcast is broadcasted, you can look it up. It's pretty awesome. There's some interesting things that are going to go down. Let's just say these guys got to throw down like their Greeks holding dishes, hashtag OPA.
Now, so I want to talk a little bit about comics just as a medium, because it's not something that I'm super familiar with, you know, kind of how they're created. And you even mentioned, and I'm sure there's other nerds listening to this podcast who are like, yeah, I already know all about, you know, the penciling and lettering and, you know, all the different parts of it. But so what was the decision to get into comics? I mean, how did you make that decision for this project?
Well, the short answer is it's something I've always wanted to do. When I was a kid, for 2 years, I took comic courses at a local night course college thing when I was a teenager. And it was really fun. I learned about all the fundamentals of making a comic. First, designing a character, giving them an origin, some history, but then just laying out panels on a page and penciling them, then tightening up the details and then inking them to make them more permanent, and coloring it and lettering it and so forth and so on. And I just really enjoyed that. But because we'll just say life gets in the way, it was a passion of mine, but it was never something that I could convert into something of a means of employment. So fast forward the clock about a decade, and I found myself moving across country. And because at that time there was more life experience being made at that point, I knew what I wanted to do for this comic. So whenever people think about comic books, they think of superheroes and spandex and doing really, really cool stuff. But most people are starting to see other options out there. The Walking Dead is a great example of that. A comic book about zombies. I mean, people are less affiliating superpowers to comics and starting to see, well, what other cool stuff is out there? I'll give a shout out at random to Chance Eggerly. I reviewed one of his comics before called An Eye for an Eye. That single issue was about 3 individuals and only 2 of them talk. It is a very interesting comic. I can't even say anything else about it without spoiling anything, but you watch it, you're like, man, that was interesting. It had nothing to do with superheroes whatsoever.
Yeah.
Mine is fantasy, and fantasy has its own league of cool. Now, there's always been fantasy comics out there. Conan in the 70s, I mean, Conan has a very loyal fan base to it, although not as big. But when it was in Marvel Comics, they did like a Savage Avengers, where for anybody that likes Marvel Comics, up in the Savage Land, up near the North Pole, there's a section that's tropical. It's the last remaining dinosaurs live there, and there's a basically not Tarzan. He's called Kazar, but he's very similar. And at one point, they just throw a bunch of Avengers in there with Conan as one of them. But he's shoulder to shoulder with like Wolverine and Frank Castle, the Punisher, and stuff. And
wow.
In a lot of cases with fantasy and comics, it's always there, but it doesn't boom like other mostly superhero themes. And I felt it was something I wanted to make something that was honest, and I wanted to do something that felt complete to me. I didn't want it to fizzle out 6, 7, 8 issues later, attempting some type of ongoing monthly or something to that effect. Instead, what I did is I just wanted 3 issues. I wanted to walk away from it and assess and make a decision from there. And I wanted it to feel like, regardless of whether it's better or not than insert classic comic here, I wanted to feel like it was worthy of being side by side with it in a comic shop, on a comic spinner, on a shelf somewhere.
The comic spinners, that takes me back to, you know, walking into the Safeway at the end of my local mall and looking for the latest episode of the new Teen Titans, or the Tales of the Teen Titans from George Perez and Marv Wolfman. Now, with the Madcaps in particular, are you responsible for only the story, or do you have any input on the visual side?
So in regards to IP, it's all myself. I am the writer. And when I write the script, and I've said this on other podcasts, if you have the term, clear, complete, concise, and correct. When I write out a script, it has to be in such a way that the person laying out all the panels, in this case, Victor Medina, he should be able to read that all over and translate it to visually on the paper. And I was told by Victor, my script is very easy to do that with. It's very important that I have creative constraints in there. Certain things have to happen. Certain things have to be seen. But if it's overly constraining, the artist's flair has a hard time blooming through what I'm trying to describe. So a really good example of this is you need some creative constraints. If I said, imagine a painting hanging on a wall, it takes a while to fill in what that painting is. But if I say, imagine a painting of a sailboat with a sunset and there's a flock of eagles above, immediately you're inspired and can snap those details and immediately think of a picture. Everybody's picture is going to be different, but it will have those details in it. And my job was to have that level of description where their flair could do the rest for me, kind of thing. And I found that the more control I gave to the artist, and although still having creative constraints, the least amount of creative constraints that I had, the better it was for the final product. And after that, Victor Medina, who also inks it, and then after that, it's passed off to Dan Kemp. Dan Kemp colors it accordingly. And then lastly, it goes through my letterer and gets combined with our covers, and then out to print and out to ship. Shout out to Philbo Publishing, Phil Russert. They do all of my Kickstarters, fulfillments. They do everything in regards to shipping, getting everything printed off, the inventory, and et cetera. It's a really cool process. I really enjoy doing it.
So we've talked a little bit about your project. Let's move into the foundational fantasy talking point, so we don't bury the lead too much for my listeners who are expecting a foundational fantasy episode. Now you can go to that.
Absolutely.
Let's do the boilerplate questions that I asked everybody. I'm trying to crowdsource. What is fantasy as a genre? So what's your take?
So my take on fantasy, I think fantasy reflects a couple of different dynamics. The first one is simpler life. It's not a simpler life, it's a more complicated life, especially with technology and infrastructure. I think that's the defining difference between fantasy and sci-fi. I think that's one thing you need for fantasy, a simpler lifestyle. Another thing is an exaggeration of physical ability, or mental, of course, as well. So being able to slay an ogre. Monsters that don't exist in the real world. You have to have that in there somewhere. And many different types of quote-unquote people. Elves, dwarves, orcs. Tabaxi, like so many different types of cool little critters and creatures out there, gnomes and halflings and many other stuff. I think all of the things I mentioned there, when you combine them, that uniquely makes fantasy.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Perfect. And, you know, why is the fantasy genre important to you?
It's important to me. Well, I guess the best way to put it is almost all problems in life can be whittled down to something at a simplified level. Not necessarily primitive, but the answer is easy. So one of the best examples, we've already mentioned Lord of the Rings. What makes Frodo so great? He has a high resistance to temptation. That's it. So just not doing the bad thing or giving in. Samwise Gamgee, if you are not Sam in your life, most likely somebody else is. And if that's not true, that's probably your calling to be a good friend like Sam. Being a good friend, being able to express something in a means that doesn't have guns and bullets and atom bombs. And it's just nice to see something that's played out with human nature, as opposed to when you put in a modern take, usually human nature is removed. And when you have something at a in a fantasy setting, people usually deep down can relate to it a little easier because of all the things that I've just mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not that you can't have world ending stakes in fantasy, obviously.
Correct.
You know, the One Ring and that kind of stuff as well.
Yes.
Yeah. So like we mentioned up top, you kind of came to fantasy through comics, through movies. So any of that, and D&D, and I think we'll get into some more of that talking about madcaps, and you already kind of mentioned it, but so like any movies or anything that you kind of want to hit on, and you mentioned them, some of them earlier, but we can sort of talk about why those movies are important to you, why they're foundational.
Okay, well, let's start with Legend. Legend is not a perfect movie.
No.
One thing I appreciate a lot from Legend is it's just different. Some people like gnarly, freaky stuff. I don't like it for those reasons. I like it because I can't compare it to anything else.
Mm.
There are some dynamics that have been used in other fantasy settings. As I already mentioned earlier, for example, the Fae and that Iron, they don't have any influence on.
Mm-hmm.
But Tim Curry and the role he plays in this giant, imposing creature, where else have we seen that before? It's ballsy. What else is good? Lord of the Rings, obviously. I've mentioned some of the dynamics. Any of the characters, I could probably extrapolate upon for probably 15 minutes. I mean, one of the most common ones is Aragorn. Somebody that respects where he comes from, but avoids it because he feels he's doomed to repeat their mistakes.
Yeah.
And then many people consider him amongst fiction of the ideal man.
Mm.
So a common buzzword nowadays is the term toxic masculinity.
Right.
Regardless of how common or uncommon that is in the world, Aragorn is the opposite to that. He is just a man.
Yeah.
And he does things that it isn't just selflessness, just nobody else is going to pull this off. Protecting those halflings and getting them to Rivendell. He gained nothing from that. And there's many individuals where they're just giving up time or parts of their lives, or as Tolkien, who went through the First World War, he reflects a lot of the battles from firsthand experience. So I remember in Return of the King where Gandalf says, whatever comes through these doors, you will not flinch. The doors fly open and it's like a pack of cave trolls armored up.
Yep.
Well, those guys, they're just giving up their lives, or even something as simple as Sam saying, you know, I saved this lambus bread for you. I've been stocking it up and rationing it off accordingly. Yeah. So we have enough. All of that self-sacrifice. I loved Arwen. One could argue this is manipulation, but I liked how she forced her father to be invested in the war.
Mm.
I've given up my mortality, so I can't go to the Undying Lands now.
Yeah.
And if you don't help out, then I'm doomed, just like everybody else. Okay, well, and I know it's a little different in the book, but in the movie, reforge the sword. All right, Aragorn, you need to fill out this role. Mm-hmm. And Aragorn is encouraged. He doesn't want to, but it's obvious he must. Let's go.
Sorry to bust in on you.
That's okay.
Like you were talking about kind of character moments in fantasy and in Lord of the Rings, the moment that Faramir goes off to Osgiliath after, you know, kind of being instructed by Denethor, you know, I don't think we should give that up so easily. And he knows he's sending him into probably certain death.
Right.
And Faramir knows it too. And Gandalf tries to talk him out of it. And he, you know, says essentially, you know, my only regret is I only have one life to give to Osgiliath or to Gondor.
Right.
But yeah, I really, really admired that.
Yeah. And I mean, Faramir's brother Boromir, he had a pretty awesome character arc. At no point, really, I don't consider Boromir a villain. But with that said, really good villains you can understand regardless of whether you agree with them or not.
Mm-hmm.
And Boromir, I fully understand where he's coming from. He just wants to do right by his people. this ring is a gift. We should use it.
Yeah.
And the whole time he's trying to convince Frodo accordingly. And by the end, he gives his life doing the right thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the scene where he dies and he says, I would have followed you, my brother, my captain, yes, my king. Like grown men just weeping.
Yes.
At least this one.
let's clarify. Not just weeping. Unapologetically weeping.
Oh, yeah.
That's like going back to... That's a man, you know?
Yeah.
And this one is obviously not as deep as Lord of the Rings, Dragonheart. I love that story, even though it hasn't aged that well. Sean Connery playing or voicing that dragon.
I am the last one.
Yeah, I am the last one. Yeah. Have you ever heard that joke about Sean Connery going to the Oscars? Uh-uh. He says to to one of his friends, every time I show my ticket, they point to the washroom and they say, I don't understand. Well, what do you ask him? He says, where do I shit?
Very nice. Very nice.
But anyways, Dragonheart, I like the story of this knight who wanted this prince to survive. And instead of accepting reality, he gives this dragon this, or he gives this kid half the dragon's heart through his actions. And, and this kid turns out being a total jerk.
Yeah.
And the dragon's like, well, I am the last one. And it's not like I'm going to die at some point. Might as well kill me and save everybody from this prince. Wow. Like that's quite the thing, right? Yeah. And the whole time the knight finally being convinced to do that, that's a very powerful moment to me.
Well, and there, I do think that movie's underrated.
Yes.
And I haven't seen it in a long time, but, just the notion that Bowen, I think that's the Dennis Quaid character.
Yes.
You know, he gives the dragon heart to, I can't remember, David Thewlis, whoever he was playing. I think that's his name. I know. Remus Lupin for Harry Potter watchers. It gives him half the heart. And then, you know, he turns out to be evil. And Bowen assumes that it was an evil influence from the dragons and goes on a crusade.
Yes.
And I mean, it's so human. Right. To be like, I don't want to accept
just pointing the finger.
This person is evil,
yes,
but that there's something else.
Yeah. It's got to be something else. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an interesting take. I also liked, in Willow, for example, I like how Willow was basically, he wants to do well. He wants to make something of himself. And at the end, how he won and defeated that sorceress at the end was something simple. He outthought her. That's what made him so great, is he outthought everything.
Right. With the disappearing pig trick.
Yes, that's right. Made the baby disappear. And that's what won it. It wasn't epic fireballs and meteors coming out of the sky and lightning bolts. It was something simple. And that was quite the statement showing his true value. He was trying too hard when in reality he was pretty awesome as he was. Despite the fact that he has to do, he wants to improve himself and be trained accordingly to be this great sorcerer.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't remember if I saw that one in the theater. I think I did. I definitely saw Dragonheart in the theater. I think it came out in the 90s.
Yes, it did. Another cool one, which is long before I was born, Jason and the Argonauts.
Oh, yeah. The Harryhausen one.
Oh, man. That lost art of stop motion, they try to emulate it now with different animation styles.
Yes.
Into the Spider-Man, Into the Spider-Verse, they do that a lot. And that made a big boom, and now a lot. Like there's a movie, animated show out called Goat right now. It's a basketball movie. They attempt that, but I think the last time, although this jumps into sci-fi, was done in Terminator at the end when the T-800 is exploited as a robot and used stop motion. But it works because it makes it feel like a robot. But going back to Jason and the Argonauts, there's many cool dynamics of that when Jason's assembling a team and Hercules shows up and the brain outsmarts him by skipping his disc to go further than how far Hercules could throw his. There's the imagery, the Titans, that first one, and it kind of looks over and everybody's like, ah, oh my goodness, it just got very serious really quick.
Yeah.
And then of course, at the end, there's the fight with the skeleton platoon. Mm-hmm. That again, because it's stop motion, it makes it feel like they're living bones, man. They're
Oh, I found them terrifying as a
yes.
kid.
Yeah. And that music with it, that mm-hmm. the person who composed that knew what they were doing. They knew their assignment, and they did it well with flying colors.
Yeah.
The looks on those, the expressions on those lifeless skulls, man.
Yeah. Oh,
terrifying.
Lots of menace.
Yes, very much so. And speaking of skeletons, on one of the covers of the Madcaps, you'll see Sarlacc, his ward. He's fending off some skeletons attacking him. There was two references for what the skeleton should feel like. One of them was the ending fight in Jason and the Argonauts. Mm. And the other one, which has a lot of comedy in it, of course, is Army of Darkness with Bruce Campbell and Sam Raimi. Mm-hmm. The skeletons in that, when you take the comedy out of it, they feel similar to Jason and the Argonauts. It's just not stop motion, or most of it isn't, I should say. Yeah. There's a lot of dynamics that are really cool. The combination of sci-fi and fantasy combined into one setting, it's hard to pull off. I love it when it's this one, it's done tongue-in-cheek when Bruce Campbell first lands into that timeline.
Yes.
And the knights capture him and they're like tinging at his car. What type of armor is this? Mm-hmm. It's just really, really cool.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good fantasy influence out there. And for I still think to this day, even though it's a lot better now than when it used to be, one of the biggest things that's helped the fantasy setting for mainstream is obviously things like Lord of the Rings. That goes without saying. But we have things like 300. We have many successful movies out there that it's okay to have muscles ripped up, furs, and a sword. It's more commonly accepted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting that, I have another podcast where we talk about adapted science fiction mostly. Every now and then we'll do fantasy as well. But there just aren't as many. There's not such a deep well of adapted fantasy films. And I think, you know, part of that is I think fantasy is often easier told in a longer form, like a book or an entire series of movies, right? And so I do feel like we are moving into a time where there's more of those adaptations because of the rise of prestige television and being able to actually use a longer form.
I have a theory, and I don't know if this is true, but back when there was that quote unquote satanic panic in D&D,
yeah,
I think people instinctively are repulsed by fantasy because of that.
Mm.
Imagine if that same panic was in the 50s. Well, I don't think Jason and the Argonauts would have ever existed. I don't think that movie would have ever existed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like I grew up in that era and, you know, the idea of playing Dungeons and Dragons or listening to heavy metal or reading Stephen King was forbidden, but you know, we went to see Lady Hawk in the theater and it explicitly has a satanic curse in it.
Yes.
And so, but my parents looked the other way for that one.
Yeah. It's all about balance, but I think when Lord of the Rings came out in theater, that was 2001, December of 2001. It's my last year of high school.
Hmm.
I watched that with my friend, and at the time, something just reflecting, like you said, it's told in a longer story. I wasn't used to that. I was disappointed that it was not one movie. I'm like, the story's not done. Why are they showing the credits? Like, let's wrap this up or keep going or something, you know?
Yeah.
As it progressed, I understood it for what it was and I appreciated it accordingly. Mm-hmm. But it makes sense where it's harder to get more of a fan base of this specific theme.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I grew up on the Rankin Bass Lord of the Rings, mixed media, right, with the animated and the live action.
Balrog is awesome in that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's so good.
I haven't seen it in so long. I have no idea how it holds up. But it's, it was big in my childhood.
Yes.
So then kind of coming from your influences, lots of your influences, or at least the foundation of your fantasy fandom coming from movies, does that influence the way you visualize things when you're thinking about campaigns, when you're thinking about translating something to comics? Are there specific things you pulled from? You mentioned Legend earlier on the Tim Curry, does that evoke kind of images in your mind?
Yes and no. So the first thing is I'm very paranoid about being a repetition of something else. So there are times that's successful. For example, the successful franchise of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah.
That started off of an homage to Daredevil.
See the Foot Clan, right?
Yeah, the Foot Clan is a direct reflection of the Hand.
Yeah.
The goo that lands on the turtles was originally supposed to be the stuff that hits Matt Murdock in the face and eventually goes down a sewer. There's a bunch of stuff that is a reflection of that. There's nothing wrong with that. But one thing I try to do is just make it unique. I want something that's thought-provoking that would make people say, huh, I've never thought of that before. In my story, for example, there's an undead outbreak. And as you've already read in the first issue, these four friends they start to become suspicious because one of the bodies, after they help the guards stave off the undead and they're taking the bodies away to be burned, one of them has no bite marks on it. And Sarlacc recognizes it as one of the local junkies, and it raises some suspicion. Is this patient zero, essentially?
Right.
And this is a kind of a Scooby-Doo whodunit, if you will, that involves tracking down some junkies and finding out, are these things mutually exclusive, or is it just a coincidence, or is there a correlation going on here? Mm-hmm. When I put this story together, I had in mind, I don't want to be a ripoff of something else. Yeah. And I've had as a compliment, I've never seen a fantasy setting involving a drug circuit. So I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
What else? One of the things about Madrakis, I don't want him to be this oafish meat shield. I wanted him to be something. His looks are not the scary part. That's the weird thing about him. So most people are like, I don't want to handle him, but he's more likely to set you on fire than he is to hack you up with his sword, assuming he's not fatigued in either ability.
Yeah. Yeah, that's totally fair. And when I ask about, you know, influences, there's sort of counter influences where you're like, I've seen all these other things and I want to do something different. I think that's really cool.
Yes, that's really cool. There's no way I can repeat that and do it better because it's so good. I'm definitely inspired, but I want it to inspire me to do something separate from that in a way, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I noticed on, the titles that you mentioned Harryhausen, you mentioned Conan and Willow and Legend and stuff. And you did mention Lord of the Rings and 300 as well, but a lot of it's older. Is there any fantasy more recently that's inspiring you?
Well, I'm a father of three and they're all under the age of 10. I don't have as much me time. So
gotcha.
I don't really sit down and watch. I'll watch a cartoon because most of them are relatively light, with the exception of something like Invincible, which I watch. A lot of modern stuff. I think everybody in Western culture, in regards to storytelling, in the last 10 to 15 years, have had a big challenge. I'm not saying whether it's good or bad, but a lot of people come from a place that is very divisive. And it's hard to draw inspiration when I'm trying to tell a story that everybody will like. And it's hard to, with modern stories in the last dozen years or so, I find myself being more disappointed than not. And I want to like these things. And it's not that I disagree with any message or anything like that, but it just feels patronizing to be told, quote unquote, bad thing is bad and you should like it too, as opposed to just letting these thoughts play out. And yes, there is ultimate good and ultimate bad, but at no point am I being preached at. Willow, for example, the evil queen, at no point am I being told she's evil and she needs to die and evil needs to be, we need to slay her so our people live. That's the good people doing the good thing. And
yeah,
I always find more inspiration from those dynamics. In my book, I do, you know what, I would have never considered this, but in my book, I reflect that very thing where these people, these four individuals, well, maybe we can find out if this drug has something to do with this outbreak, because maybe Ivy would benefit from this. At no point, and I've said this on other podcasts, at no point am I saying, like the 80s and 90s, the arcades, they always had that big blue screen with the American crest on it that said, winners don't use drugs. I'm not here to do that.
Right.
My story happens to have drugs in it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I leave it up to the reader to, I like this story because I relate to it, or I like this character. I actually really hate them and I'm enjoying hating them. I would rather them feel it out like that.
Mm-hmm.
And modern stories, I feel, lacks just that final layer of depth. I don't know how else to explain it.
I got you. Okay, I think that'll probably wrap it for Foundational Fantasy. We didn't go into a ton of depth about any of the movies. I don't feel, you can obviously pull in a lot of strings in a movie or a series of movies, but I just kind of wanted to get a sense for how they influenced you and how that kind of comes out in your comics. And I really enjoyed that your point about trying to be unique. So let's go ahead and talk in more detail about Madcaps and the Kickstarter. Okay.
Right on.
Do you want to go through who the characters are?
Sure. Which one would you like me to start with? Which one appeals to you the most?
Madrakis.
Now, for anybody that watched the original Power Rangers, I refer to Madrakis as the Green Ranger of the group. The Green Ranger is always like a fan favorite. He's always considered the coolest. He does some really cool things, but doesn't really put in the finishing blow, if you will. Everybody loves Madrakis for that.
Yeah.
Madrakis, he hails from his bloodline comes from a large individual known as the Great Stormworm, which is essentially a kaiju caliber electric eel that lives out in the ocean.
Okay.
Despite him being over 350 pounds in body weight and clearing 6.5 feet in height, he is very, people consider that scary, but the scariest thing is his brain. He dabbles with the arcane and he hasn't had time to strengthen those studies, but he has a lot of potential to do so. And you see that a little bit in the book. One of the first times he catches a creature by the throat and sets his head on fire and throws it aside, saying, "Let's mess this way." Mm-hmm. Another cool thing about him, because of what he descends from, he's able to store raw lightning in his gizzard and vomit it out at will. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's limits to it, no different than a skunk with its smelly defense mechanism or
some recharge time.
Yeah, he would have to regenerate that, or a poisonous snake with venom in its fangs, the same thing. He can only hold so much in him. He is also raised by humans and hatched from an egg and raised by humans that he doesn't know too much about himself. He's not a common creature. Mm-hmm. And many individuals, when you look at him because of the armor he's wearing, you'd think he's some soldier or seasoned mercenary. But in reality, that's all ceremonial based off of the little he knows about his people. Mm. But in reality, he doesn't have any context to... or you don't have any context to what he's capable of doing. But when it comes to swinging that sword of his, I mean, he could swing it hard, but mm-hmm. that doesn't make him a skilled fighter. These guys aren't the most proficient of survivors out in the realm. So when you see him, you'd think otherwise, but a really skilled fighter could probably take him on going toe-to-toe.
Right, and I appreciated that it was either the first or the second episode where one of them was like, are we sure we're the people to try and tackle this issue?
Yes. Two things. The first one is in the first issue when they, during that outbreak within the first six pages that they help the guards stave off, at one point, three of them almost get overrun and they're saved by guards, which is, I've made this joke before. This is like William Shatner getting saved by a bunch of red shirts.
Right.
I wanted to really make it feel like there was some gravity and some stakes for their decisions. I didn't want them to feel like they just couldn't lose no matter what. I wanted to feel like, are they actually going to make it? Mm-hmm. And that's definitely going to be explored upon and exploited, if you will, in issue three. Madrakis, He likes solitude. In the very first couple of pages of issue one, they have to give their names before they enter Ivywood, him and Dunnan. And Madrakis is reluctant to even get back to the town. He gets some flack from the guards up front. And all he says is, Ivywood's charges against me were dropped. And as he's talking to Dunnan, he says, I'd rather be somewhere with my nose in a book. And I really hate the trope of big, strong, dumb guy of group is not just dumb, but no, is good for nothing more than being a meat shield or some type of one big haymaker for another dumb guy on the other side or something to that effect.
Yeah.
But this guy, I wanted to turn that on his head. Yeah, he's out of the four of them, he's large and in charge, but his spell casting is the scary stuff. Or I should say his potential of spell casting is the scary stuff.
Well, and so people who are coming from more experience with D&D than I have, you know, I grew up during the Satanic Panic, so, you know, that was a good way to get you some demons.
I understand.
But instead of recognizing D&D for what it is a way to tell stories, right? You have a troop of people who, you know, they're all different character classes and races, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got a dark elf, I think.
He's actually, you know what, let's talk about him next. That is Chasgo Blundale. Chasgo Blundale is a species of elves known as an Augur. Augurs.
Silver.
Yeah. Yes. Augurs. I think you're the first person to catch that reference. Augurs live in a mountain range.
There's a condition where people get kind of blue silver skin.
That's correct.
Or something. Sorry.
Yes. So humans in real life, if they consume enough silver, it actually tattoos their skin cells and they're permanently blue. And one of the most famous ones, the guy was interviewed on Oprah. He looks like Papa Smurf. It does not look real. It looks fake. It looks like he's getting ready to be on set for some sci-fi episode.
Mr. Freeze.
Star Trek. Yeah. Yeah. It looks very strange. But
yeah. Yeah, there was a guy, I live in Oregon, we used to not be able to pump our own gas. There was a guy who pumped gas at a station near me who had that condition. And so I had to look it up.
Interesting. Well, anyways, Chasgo's people, they're plain old elves, but they live in this mountain range that is predominantly riddled with silver deposits. And they worship that mountain. They're considered what many would call xenophobic. They want nothing to do with outsiders. So, because it's also fantasy, all of that silver in their system makes them highly resistant to magic. So because they don't like outsiders and because they're pretty tough, pretty vicious, and not even mages want to deal with them, any merchants or mercenaries or anything, they will usually take the long route to avoid going through that range of mountains. Chasgo feels his people are dysfunctional, so he wanted to leave. The problem is most settlements that see an Augur will kill him on sight because usually that means trouble. Chasgo was approached by a being only known as Annette. In the first issue, that book is narrated by Chasgo writing a letter to Annette explaining what is happening. Annette gave him a chess piece, which is a rook. Chasgo fashioned it in the form of a necklace, and if he has that with him, he has some magical gifts. He's able to, one of the most important ones, of course, being he can hide his appearance. So he has disguised himself as a human and he's been living in a human settlement. Many people aren't really sure why he's dancing so close to danger because he's the representative of a noble. And many people would say, well, why? Anytime if you were exploited, you'd be killed. Like, what are you doing? And that has not been explored yet in this story. So, most people really like Chasgo. He's got a three-eyed albino crow for a pet. Its name is Amex. And some cool things have been shown with him in issue two. He can see through its eyes, for example, which they use to scout out a bandit headquarters just to see what the lay of the land and who is where and stuff. Almost like his own drone rather, if you're using it in modern comparisons. Most people find Chasgo very interesting because he has a classic take of don't judge a book by its cover. And I think many individuals can really relate to, nobody wears 100% of their identity on their sleeve, especially on first impressions. If you had a very weird thing, if you were into shooting guns and taxidermy and you told somebody that up front, you'd probably maybe appalled. There's a good chance of that, where Chasgo is an extreme of that. He can't say where he came from and he can't even show people what he really looks like.
Yeah.
And other than the other three individuals in the story, nobody knows that.
It's funny because, you know, being dropped into the middle of the story, kind of like it is in the first issue, when you first meet him, I was picturing him as a Lando Calrissian type, kind of a rogue, you know, kind of like, hey, I'm in this position, but you know, this isn't the real me.
Yeah. It's very neat to listen but playing out his dialogue. He's a very careful individual, which is very, very understandable. I really enjoy in issue two, he's kind of pressured into disguising himself just so they can dupe some bandits and find a means into infiltrating a hideout. And it plays out very well. In issue one, when that outbreak starts, he can't help his friends because if he does anything, his disguise will be exploited and he couldn't afford to do that. So he says that up front and his friends say, just go and get help. That's how you'll help us. And it's kind of cool seeing him have to do alternative methods to get similar results compared to his friends.
Nice. I apologize. I don't remember the names of all the characters off the top of my head.
The next one I'll talk about is Sarlacc Swamp Trudger. He's a full-blooded dwarf.
Right. The first time I saw the name, I thought that was Madrakis, just because Sarlacc, you know, sounds Star Wars influenced, and it just kind of sounds serpentine a little bit to me.
It kind of feels that a little bit, yes. Yeah. Sarlacc is an interesting dwarf. His group of dwarves, many generations ago, left the mountains and wanted to work the soil and grow crops and work with livestock. Because at the time they chose to start in the middle of swamplands, which surprise, surprise, being stubborn dwarves, over time, over generations, they've been able to, essentially terraform that swamp from the inside out. So they are continuously trying to make their lands better. Culturally speaking, because of that, Madrakis is well-versed in tracking and pacifying things that go bump in the night. Swamplands and fantasy, I mean, it's pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah.
He worships something known as the divine, and he has had a calling to what he refers to as being a beacon of light to those less fortunate in the town of Ivywood. Unlike Madrakis, who can't hide who he is, or Chasko, who fully hides who he is, Sarlacc feels there's more important things to worry about. So he goes into a place that's fully human. He stands out like a sore thumb, but he wants to do right by those less fortunate. He has some blessings because of his devotion to the divine. In the first issue, you see it a little bit. You'll see it in issue three, where he has a defensive ward, which kind of repels the undead and protects him a bit. He's got some other cool stuff I have not been able to show yet, but you'll see it in full force in issue three. It's going to be a good time.
Excellent. So he's kind of a paladin?
You know what? If I had to transfer it to D&D, because D&D was the basis, but I kind of made it more fantasy, if that makes sense, even though D&D is fantasy. If I had to translate him, like in the character sheets I have for this Kickstarter, he's kind of a combination between ranger and cleric. He's almost like an axe wielding holy man of the woods.
Okay. Nice. In the game Munchkin, there's like the holy chainsaw of bloody dismemberment.
Munchkin's a good clerics. Game.
So yeah.
Yes. And then, the last character is Dunanini. Dunanini, much like the last three characters that I've mentioned. And I mean, any character in fiction, they all inadvertently explore the thought of who am I and how do I fit in the world? And all four characters express that very, very differently. Dunanini, he is a half gnome, half dwarf. And he's a little bit shorter than your average dwarf, but he can't grow a beard. Similar to how his mother has magical influence on nature, he seems to have a similar influence on metals and crystalline structures. One of his coolest things, contraptions that he's been able to put together, is that telescope, which peeks over his shoulder and just blasts raw arcana out of it. It's synced to his goggles. If he's wearing his goggles, he can make that telescope work. He's not exactly sure why, but he believes it's because of the mix of the two bloodlines. Dunanini, he has a hard time fitting in with, he draws from both bloodlines, but he has a hard time fitting in with either culture. Because of that, he can establish a bond just as heavily with a friend as he would a family member. And the very first page of issue one is him explaining why he thinks so highly of these people. And you kind of see that. It explores it a bit more in issue two, and you'll see a bit more of it in issue three. It's a good time, man. It's been torture not being able to talk about this third and final issue, because I've been releasing issue one, two, and now three. Each one was on in April. So it's been like 2.5 years of just not saying anything about this.
and just to reiterate with the campaign for issue three starts on the 16th of April.
16th of April. That's okay, correct.
So it'll already be in full swing by the time this comes out.
Yes.
And it goes for a month. Is that what you
yes.
said?
Yes.
Okay. And so that means it's available essentially for people to get.
All three issues you'll be able to back. There's some cool stuff on there. You'll be able to see t-shirts and blankets. You'll be able to see there's a map of where this story takes place that I had drawn by Storm Wickham and colored by Dan Kemp. It's beautiful. There's a bunch of different covers. There's one of Chasgo Blundale that you'll see on the pre-launch, or you'll be able to see it by the time this comes out. Everything white on that cover is going to be glow in the dark.
Oh, cool.
The cover of Dunn and Eni, where he's walking away from a flaming building, that's going to be lava foil. And there's some cool, there's a good one of Madrakas. There's an excellent one of Sarlacc. And one of the things that I try to do with covers is I try to have covers foreshadow or reflect something that's happening in the issue that you're buying. I don't like false advertisement.
Yeah.
I like the old Amazing Spider-Man. I remember, I think it's Amazing Spider-Man issue number 56, where him and Doc Ock are robbing a bank on the cover. And I want to read why this is happening. And it turns out Peter Parker gets amnesia and Doc Ock convinces him to work with him. But I try to have my comics do something like that visually. So there's a main protagonist cover, which was drawn by my interior artist and colored accordingly. There's a main antagonist cover, which is drawn by Harv Salteras and colored by Dan Kemp. And then I have a variant cover of each character. There's also a tribute to Final Fantasy of the NES, 8-bit. By the time this comes out, you'll be able to see it. I don't think it's on the pre-launch by the time during this recording, but it's done by Jenna Stark. And then lastly, with Rod Ramos Rodolfo, there's going to be a special edition trilogy where you can get all three issues, but with brand new covers. And when you combine the covers, it makes one image that depicts the final act of the third issue. And it's fire. I am a big fan of how all these covers came out. They're really beautiful. I'm very proud of my team that helped me get these things done.
Nice. Is this your first foray into comics?
Yes.
You know, as professionally kind of.
Yeah, I've always loved comics. This is my first time on the creative side. It's one of the reasons why it's only a mini series. I wanted to take my time. I wanted it to be awesome. And then I wanted to walk away with it. And in my mind, I wanted it to feel like it was worthy of the industry, worthy of being in your local comic shop. But after that, I wanted to take a step back and see if I want to keep doing this. I'm enjoying it, but it's up to the fan base if it's justified to keep going. It's not my day job, and my wife and family are our top priority. We'll see how this goes.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have ideas about where you'd go with continuing with the characters, if not the story?
These characters, I have point form, everything that happens to them leading up to their metaphorical deathbeds.
Okay.
So if I wanted to keep going, I definitely could.
All right. Well, that'd be good for anybody who wants to back the project, you know, the potential of, if it takes off, plenty of story left to unfold.
Definitely.
Oh, so, I mean, we haven't really, I mean, I'll make sure to put a link in the show notes to any links to the campaign and that kind of stuff, but just verbally, where can people go?
So if you want to find me on social media, you can find me as DM Ray on Facebook, also known as DM is short for Dungeon Master. That's self-explanatory.
Yeah.
You can find the Madcaps Facebook page. You can also find me on Instagram as Raymond the DM. DM Ray was taken, unfortunately. But most importantly, find us on Kickstarter. Have a look at what's on there. There's a really cool trailer. There's I got professional voice actors to play out the characters. There's just so much to be seen on it. And I mean, It's kind of cheap when I pump myself up, but I keep getting repeat customers that are enjoying this story. So it's encouraging for me to keep going. This Kickstarter here, by the time we've during this recording, I've almost tied my all-time best follower count on a Kickstarter, either pre or post launch, and we haven't even launched it yet. So I know people are they seem to be liking what I'm providing. So I'm happy to give it to them.
Yeah.
The only thing I can say in regards to this third issue, these are individuals where, as I've already mentioned, this takes place over one night. So this is the end of the night. These are people that have beat themselves up a little bit. These are people that are not their freshest. They're pulling an all-nighter. They are not the most suited for this job, but if they go and try to get the most suited or better suited individuals, that's not really going to, it's not going to work for them. They're limited for time. And as it says on the pre-launch, these guys are trying to hunt down a necromancer that's trying to put a curse on their town. This necromancer has not even been mentioned in the first two issues. Yeah. So these guys have been playing catch up the entire time, and we're going to find out if they've played catch up fast enough or not. Mm-hmm. And they're tired. They're not at their best. And they are, as you've already mentioned in issue two, they mention, are we suited to do this or should we be talking to somebody else about it? You're going to see all of that come into one big climactic reveal. We'll put it that way.
Perfect. Nice. All right. Well, I'm going to encourage my listeners to go check out the campaign and see if they want to back it. I know I've got a lot of people that listen to the podcast that are big D&D folks, and so I think they'll like some of the influences there. And it's really cool that you were able to parlay your experience with running campaigns and creating characters, and then it's already storytelling, but then being able to put it down in this form is really, really cool.
It's been a great time.
Okay, Ray, well, I think we've talked about where people can find you and where they can find the Kickstarter. And I'm certainly going to be watching for that for the issue three to open up. And looking forward to I'm going to have to get it because I got to know how this comes out.
Right on. I appreciate it.
Well, it's really cool just to kind of get some insight into how it works with getting something in comics. And I love all the kind of democratization of art that has happened. It's not all good, but but it's nice for creators to have a variety of places to try and get their work out there.
Yes, I hear you.
All right, Ray, it was great talking to you. Thanks so much for reaching out to me, and I hope people will check out the project. It's really cool.
Back to Madcaps, something unique, something different, and something I would say is intellectually stimulated, something I'm very proud of, and I think it's something that you can really like. Please back. Thank you kindly.
All right. Bye now. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that. It was a little bit different. And because of that, I'll probably just release this episode in the middle of the month, just kind of like a bonus episode almost. Still fits in the foundational fantasy, but mostly we talked about the project. I thought it was a cool project. I'm going to look at it and see about backing it, because I really want to see how the story comes out. But do check out the links in the show notes and let me know what you think. All right. As always, you can support this podcast if you like to. Links are in the show notes, so check that out. And thanks everybody so much for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye.
The theme music for the Who Goes There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky.